Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, we are going to visit with Zuhal Bailey this afternoon. He and his cello are in Juno for the weekend, and we'll talk about what he's up to in just a bit, as well as why he has re-recorded his famous Bach cello suites. Listen, it was so beautiful. Why would he have to re-record it? Well, we will talk to Zuhal about why he's re-recording this masterpiece, but now we're going to join him from Sitka, where he is the artistic director for the Sitka Summer Music Festival, and now he's got yet another hat to wear. He is artistic director of Juno Jazz and Classics, and we have to ask you, what's it like wearing so many hats these days, and how many are you wearing, Zuhal?
Rhonda, it's so great to be here to talk to you again. I wish we could be in the same room together, but it's a pleasure to speak to you. It's very strange for me to hear that recording of Bach. We can start with that really quickly. You know, I recorded that back in 2008 and took me years, in fact, about 7 or 8 years preparing for that recording. And it kind of symbolized something of an awakening for me in my 20s. When I just gotten out of school, I was alone, finally in the world, and not in the bubble of a school. And I'll just say it. It helped me find my way from mid-20s to early 30s. It helped me find my voice. It helped me make decisions for myself for the first time away from teachers. So to document that was very, very important because of what it meant to me personally. The Bach cello suites for cellists are their cellistic Bible. We don't have the manuscript. So basically we as interpreters have to make up the rules of dynamics and tempo and all these kinds of things. And they basically mirror where we are at any particular time of day or in our lives. So in 2008, I was in a very interesting kind of transition in my life when I put those things down, when I recorded it that week. And I really did think I maybe would revisit them in a recording situation later in life, but I wanted to see how life would kind of bash me around first to see how it would change my interpretations of these suites. And then came the pandemic, being alone for so much of the year, trying to kind of needing a guiding light. I began revisiting these Bach cello suites, but in a very different way, in a very simple, much more simplified way. I began refining my life down to necessities versus just so much noise that had accumulated in my life over the past 30 years. Happenstance occurred. A recording label asked if I would consider recording them on their label called Octave Records. And I asked them about their recording, and they said that it's a specialized audiophile CD company, a recording company that specializes in recordings that are 175 times that the fidelity of a CD. It's so much more definition, and the technology has gone so much further than when I was in 2008. And they also wanted to release it on an LP, which I found fascinating, to put it back on the old records. So I was in a very interesting place psychologically when that phone call came in October, and I accepted their proposal. So in January, I was in an empty hall in Mesa, Arizona, a 3,000-seat hall by myself because of COVID, and mics hanging everywhere. And for 1 week, I just bathed in Bach. It was a very different experience, a very intimate experience compared to the first time I performed them and recorded them. So I think this will be a very different, exponentially different rendition of them, symbolizing what I went through in being kind of solitary and thoughtful this year in the pandemic.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Suite Number 1 in G Major. You want to set this up for us?
Yes. Well, I guess we'll listen to the prelude. The fact is that what Bach was trying to figure out is how to make the cello a functioning, multifaceted instrument back in 1717. And the issue was no composer had been able to figure out how to compose on what was a single-lined instrument. So what I mean by that is that the cello's role in an ensemble back in 1717 was to play the bass tones. The violin were the melody. Of course, a trumpet or a soprano or a singer would be the melody as well. But Then you'd have the viola that would be the harmonies, and then the intertwinings of the second violin or whatnot in an orchestra would be. So you'd have all these different voices, and no composer until this experiment had figured out a way to play all of those many voices without disturbing a beautiful melody. And it's interesting, and I'll just set it up quickly. The prelude is his first attempt. It is in the kind of the neck of the instrument. It's beautiful G major, simple key, rings beautifully. But if you notice, he gets around not disturbing the melody by not providing a melody. He provides a harmonic sequence, and there are these chords that build off each other. And if you listen very, very carefully, you'll hear the melody Ave Maria subliminally, kind of as the chords progress. So this is a beautiful sunrise, prelude number one in G major by Johann Sebastian Bach.
So, Zuhl, the last time I heard you play that piece, I was reporting on a trip that you took to Mykorek. It's a village on Nelson Island out in the Bering Sea. And wow, did the people in that community really eat up that concert? You were there with Piers Lane, a world-class pianist. And of course, that school didn't even have a piano. You had to bring the piano there. So that was such a special moment. And when we saw the sunrise come up in Mykorek, boy, that music really fit the glorious orange of the sky.
Absolutely. I'll never forget also when I played that piece, I invited the young people from Mykorek to come around me and to sit around the cello because the inpan is sitting on the floor. And I'll never forget one of the young boys got so close that he actually grabbed my end pen, the post that holds up my cello, so he could feel the vibrations that were vibrating from this wooden box into the floor. And it was a really magical moment that kind of, again, describes how music shakes us and vibrates us and reminds us that we're human. And so I always play that piece wherever I go because I think it's, again, such a nice entryway into the sounds of the cello. It just sounds like everything's going to be okay. And in fact, I start most of my days with that piece when I warm up in the mornings because it also just feels good on the body to warm up with it. So Bach has been very special to me. In fact, it's how I was introduced to Juno Jazz and Classics in, I think, 2010, 2011, when Linda Rosenthal, the founder and creator of Juno Jazz and Classics, asked that I come there to kind of bring an event that had never been done like that before. And I played all six suites in one sitting. It basically established an annual visit that I was so blessed to be able to come be a part of Juno since then. So it's already been well over a decade of coming there every year. So Juno feels very much like home to me.
Your base of operations has been basically out of Sitka, which has enabled you to come back and forth between Juno and Sitka. And of course, there seems to be a common denominator between those two locations, and that has three words, Linda and Paul Rosenthal.
Well, it's true. Well, what brought me to Alaska was just a random tour in 2004. I never thought that I would come back or be back because I had never been to Alaska or knew really many people that went to Alaska, at least the way I went. A lot of people come on cruise ships and things like this, but I came to Sitka 2007, to the Sitka Music Festival. It had this legendary status. It has a legendary status because of Paul and all of his colleagues. And I had a life-changing summer. 2007. And I didn't want to leave, and nor did I ever think I would come back. And he invited me back in 2008. And then subsequently, conversations led to him inquiring whether or not I would like to spend a lot more time in Alaska and be his successor. That would be in 2012. His final festival, his 40th anniversary, his 70th birthday, was in 2011. And so, again, a dream come true. And I accepted and now spend, because of that and that rooting system of being here in the entire state, I spend about 3 to 4 months a year in Alaska. And a bulk of that is in the Southeast here. And so I feel incredibly lucky to have not only gotten to know the wishes and the dreams of Linda and Paul, but have gotten to know how music is so vital to the touring system to bring to the entire state, to the villages, to not just Sitka or Juneau, and also the eclectic diversity in the programming, which actually makes them a beautiful combination. You know, it's jazz and classics in Juneau. It's, you know, this is kind of where we're going in the world right now with how the world has become so much smaller with the internet. It's kind of a melting pot of different kinds of music, not just strictly classical. I mean, Linda was definitely a visionary when she began kind of fusing the two kinds and many kinds of music together in the early 1980s, since beginning this festival as the founder. And Paul, of course, you know, establishing what a music festival really is, you know, pick a place in paradise, bring the greatest musicians on earth, play the greatest music, and they will come. The diversity in the programming that is possible between Juneau and Sitka, with the jazz element and with the kind of the world music, as well as the classics in Juneau, as well as the staples of classical music and the educational components in both, in Sitka as well. The sky's the limit is what is possible for the state through those two organizations. I am thrilled to be involved.
Back when I first met you, you know, you talked a lot about the healing power of music and how it makes such a difference that you could see it everywhere you traveled. So now that we've been in this time of COVID, are you feeling that more than ever?
100%. And that's one of the primary reasons that I'm coming to Juneau tomorrow morning. Music is definitely a distractor. It's a healer. It kind of makes us pause and be present. It relaxes us. It kind of soothes the anxieties away. It also just kind of makes everything feel okay. So I'll be playing not only in the church services for Easter Sunday, but I'll be playing at the vaccination clinics. I'll be playing at the hospitals for the night shift as well as the day shift. I'll be popping up all over town, but basically just trying to give a soundtrack of beauty the cello does so well throughout the entire city and region of there, that whole area this weekend. And I'm very much looking forward to it. Also, we're getting ready to kind of launch and discuss our first hybrid festival that we're going to have in May, a festival where we're going to have live performances as well as virtual, and start to kind of come back in this new reality of ours.
And it very much is a new reality. Did you learn some things about performance during this time of COVID? I know you did a lot of virtual concerts.
I found the virtual concerts very difficult at first. The first 6 months, I found them very hands-off, and I'm so used to seeing and you know, people being so tangible and seeing their faces and smiling. And that was kind of the fuel that kept me going as a performer. And to not have that and to barely see it on a screen and be playing for a camera just didn't give that to me. The good news is that we were able to still exchange beautiful things in safe ways. And the good news is that it forced us as individuals and organizations to learn new techniques to be able to access and bring education as well as concerts and consistent arts to places that we couldn't physically get to all the time. So there have been a lot of upshots here and an evolution in how we can really bring the world's greatest things to people, but nothing will take the place of face-to-face.
No, nothing ever does. And of course, to feel the vibrations of the music, like you described, how those kids in the Mokoriak gym just kind of wanted to sit around your cello and feel the vibrations. But what did you learn about this new way of performing for big audiences in the last year?
Big audiences. I mean, the most people that I played for at one time was a school engagement where I played for 9,000 kids on the computer at one time, and all these different schools all tuned in. I was astounded by the impact that made, being that I couldn't see any of them. I just taught about the history of music, how music makes us feel. I played some beautiful things. I showed contrasts. I showed them that a classical instrument can play all different kinds of music and all different kinds of sounds. Subsequently got cards and emails and all these things that people are just frenzying for more of that. But again, I'm used to seeing my audience. I'm used to feeling and walking through them to go to the stage. I'm used to being able to talk and one-on-one after concerts. And I really did miss that. And it made me also realize what concerts really are. They're community gatherings. They're inspiring events that get us together for us to be inspired to then kind of inspire other things to take away. It really did expand the importance of what I believe a concert stands for, or a cultural event, and that just gets us out of our houses, rallies our families together, that creates conversations and new thoughts. So I think that one of the things that will be the most interesting is how, as we come back into this next chapter, we won't take that for granted anymore. I think you have to sadly lose something to really realize how precious something really is. None of us ever dreamed that being together could be taken away from us so quickly.
Boy, that is the truth. One of the interesting things, though, about this time of the pandemic is that in these virtual venues, people were more accessible. You could have much bigger audiences. And so I wonder if there's maybe kind of in the end a win-win, that these virtual audiences, which were accessible and in some ways less costly than maybe a $80 concert ticket, if that will bring people back to classical music, exposing it to them and making them want to be there in person.
I see it. I think you're right. Absolutely. I see it from just slightly a different standpoint. I think that some people want to experience things away from other people. I think some people want to be in the comforts of their own home to feel and then feel comfortable with that. And I think that the best case scenario would be to continue to do what we do and move forward with live concerts, but to add an element of the virtual for those who would like to experience it on their own. I've heard a lot of churches have had this happen, where the numbers have gone skyrocketing because people can experience their religion in their own homes at their own pace. And so Sunday school classes as well as services have quadrupled in size because they just make it very accessible. So I see both. Yes, of course, it might have people come and want to try it out. But I think that some people who don't like to drive at night, some people who, when it's a rainy day in the afternoon, they don't want to risk it by taking their car out and being in the elements, will stay home. But they can still access the concert. And they can access it in a way that makes it consistent throughout the entire year, which I think is going to be very special. And I look forward to, as a curator / artistic director, whatever you call it, trying to come up with new and innovative ways to keep doing that, in addition to the educational component.
With Juno Jazz and Classics, I could see you being the artistic director for half of the equation. You know, I really don't know much about your experience with jazz, and I'm curious how you'll be involved with that part of the festival.
Well, I've been very, very lucky through my career to be surrounded by very smart people and people who also kind of swing in different circles. One of the things that's so wonderful about traveling as I do, being an ambassador for Alaska, is that I can see how other people program and see what's successful, what's fiscally responsible, what people love and what brings them out, and also hear them myself live. I have affiliated myself as a curator with the Mesa Arts Center in Arizona for the past, oh my gosh, I think about 10 years. And I spend a lot of time when I'm down in that area with them and my colleagues there. The Jazz from Lincoln Center is in residence there, and they have been for a long time. They have a complete jazz component to their series. And when this idea of needing to gather information about jazz and other things like that, I immediately went to those who've done it a long time and knew way more than I did. And they basically shared all of their information with me immediately because we trust each other. And so I immediately come with a very large black book of information to be able to bring ensembles of all different shapes and sizes to the area. Everything from solo piano to jazz trio to duos to big band to everything. And I'm just waiting for the time that we can do it safely.
I'm just kind of curious. I would just love to hear you play some jazz cello.
You're going to have to wait a long time for that. I always let the best people do the showcase. I would much rather sit in the back with a nice glass of wine or a glass of champagne and watch someone who's excellent at that. There are some things out there, like Claude Bowling, who wrote some things that are kind of fun, classical and jazz fusions that I have experimented with over the years. But I tell you, when you see someone do it really well, it is something to behold. And I certainly would experiment more and more over the coming years, but you will rarely see me. We'll have to make that a fundraiser. How much money can we raise to get me up on stage to play jazz?
Boy, now that would be worth seeing. I would like to see that. But one thing that you've often said, I've heard you say this before, that classical music as it was performed long ago is very different than today, where musicians would perform and people would be dining. And also musicians then also did improvising, which is one of the key things of jazz. They would show off fancy cadenzas and just kind of go off on their own sort of musical journeys that weren't scripted. And so I just wonder, by bringing these two festivals together, are we going to see a new side of classical music maybe?
Well, we have to. I mean, we have to continue to evolve. I think what you were alluding to, and the public should know, is that basically, you know, before 1900s, the 1900s, most of the featured performers were people playing their own works. They were the composers showcasing their own works. Brahms would come to the table and play with guests. They would play his work. And during that work, there might be a section where everyone would stop and they would improvise and would play what you called a cadenza, which is, I call it a cadenza too. But it's a section where it's kind of free flow. And then you get someone like Rachmaninoff, who adored jazz. And you hear lots of jazz in his works. He incorporates even jazz instruments like saxophones and things like this. And then you have to think about people like George Gershwin as being jazzy. And we've evolved to a place where we've really have brought the two together. And these days, it's very acceptable to have them on the same concert, where you have some classical, strictly classical things that were the highlights of the classical history, as well as forward-looking things that were inspired by that history. It's always good to know where you've come from, to know where you're going. And with world music and fusion and all of this stuff that's happening now, I think the road is brightly lit for the future of the arts through Juneau Jazz and Classics and throughout the state.
Well, I think what we've learned between the two events, the Juneau Jazz and Classics, as well as the Sitka Summer Music Festival, is that it's still good to dream. And I understand that one of your dreams is coming to fruition at the Sitka Summer Music Festival now.
You're talking about the fact that it's a milestone year for, again, the Sitka is turning 50 this year. And we're also inaugurating and opening a brand new music center here, which is good for Juneau because it will bring me and a lot of artists to this area and have kind of a place that they can live and breathe and be here longer and travel back and forth between Juneau and Sitka a lot. So it'll bring a lot of education hands-on and consistency in touring. You know, what I love about Alaska is that it takes care of itself. It's community-driven. The community ensures that everyone is healthy and strong. And so we have this new building, the Minor Music Center at Stevenson Hall. Stevenson Hall was on the Sheldon Jackson campus. It's where the Sitka Festival began back in 1972. Then it began spilling outwards. And of course, under the same roof with Paul and Linda, she began with the same kind of impact, if not even broader, with the jazz element and these kinds of things about a decade later, the jazz and classics. So I kind of see, and this is semantics, but I see all of the things that are happening with Juno and this evolution and the fact that the Juno and Sitka were under the same roof with Linda and Paul for the majority of their histories. I see it as the perfect storm of what's happening now, with the fact that we have this new building, the fact that we have been collaborating for years, and the fact that I've been going to Juno well before I was asked to be this person as the artistic director now. There's a tremendous amount of trust and roots and friendships and family. I couldn't have dreamt or dreamed of a better position to be in.
Well, I just have one last question for you is, do you feel that Juno and Sitka are places where there is an incredible amount of musical talent per capita as opposed to maybe other communities you visited? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are lots of places in the country that have this love and passion for music.
I do notice that the arts are alive more so in Juno and Sitka than other places, at least, you know, based on population and the way it's featured and taken care of. I couldn't imagine these two wonderful treasures not being culturally centric. You're correct. I think that the arts really do define Juno and Sitka, and they also define the people. Some of the most creative, intelligent, thoughtful, wonderfully caring people I've ever met are in Juno and Sitka. And everything is very real and, more importantly, reality-based. I feel that there's nothing artificial about anything that I've experienced in Sitka and Juno. These are the crown jewels of Alaska, and so close. Was it 90 miles or something like that? Again, the sky's the limit for the arts now in Alaska, and cheers to Paul and Linda for being such amazing visionaries and being the examples, quite frankly, for so many hundreds of other festivals around the world that have modeled how the arts can change and inspire a community.
Well, we're going to let you go because I know that we were very lucky to have this much time with you. I know your time in Alaska is very precious. So I want to thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon. It was great to hear what you're up to. And it's always a lot, I know.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I can't wait to see everybody. Hopefully you'll hear, if you walk outside in Juno for the next 5 days, you'll hear cello in the air. And if you do, it's me. I'm the Pied Piper. Follow me out and you'll see people, and we'll celebrate through music and the arts, the Juno Jazz and Classics.
Okay, so great talking to the Pied Piper of cello playing. Thanks, Zuhl.
Thank you, Rhonda. Take care.
Zuhl Bailey, director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, as well as director now of the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival.